Good morning, everyone. I'm standing right under a speaker. That's probably a bad move on my part. My voice is definitely not going to hold out without the mic, though. So welcome. Good morning. Thanks for coming in bright and early on the travel day. So this morning, I was encouraging the first few folks to sit toward the front. And if anyone else wants to accept my encouragement to come forward, please do. We're going to have a good conversation, we hope, with all of you. Conversation is our aim this morning. So our plan is to share with you some insights from the MISO survey. This is a conversation that we're calling Setting the Stage for Success, and we've got an analysis on innovation to share with you, as well as an analysis on the nature of faculty at different stages in their career. So we're going to talk less and hopefully have you guys contribute more, offer your thoughts on what the data means, what actions it suggests, and what future avenues for investigation are really needed to understand this stuff even better. So let me start with an introduction, and then we'll tell you a little bit about the MISO survey, give you a sense of what we offer, and then dive into this first story about innovation. I'm Josh Wilson from Brandeis University. I'm a member of the seven-person MISO survey management team. My MISO colleague, Kevin Creamer, from the University of Richmond, is also here this morning. So we're your MISO tour guides this morning. So let me tell you just a little bit about the MISO survey, and then we will dive in. Come on in. Welcome. So MISO is a web-based quantitative survey. We've been around since 2005, and MISO stands for Measuring Information Service Outcomes. And the reason that's important is that this survey really does provide actionable results that participating institutions can use to inform the decisions that they need to make and to guide service improvement. Certainly at Richmond and Brandeis, we have done a lot of that. I've done a pile of it at Brandeis, and Kevin has as well. So MISO measures the effectiveness of library and IT services in higher education. And we'll talk a little bit more about the instrument in a few minutes. But our contention is that our campus constituents view these services in a continuum, regardless of how IT and library organizations are structured. Combined, not combined, at each other's throats, not at each other's throats. Our constituents, we believe, see these services together. So the survey looks at them together. So the survey is, we believe, just as good for those institutions with merged organizations as those institutions with separate IT and library organizations. MISO places a focus on three primary populations: faculty, undergraduates, and staff. And we have had a very large pool of respondents since the survey's initial launch in 2005. So we've had about 66,000 total respondents since 2005. As you can see up here, there are piles. So these numbers include all of the responses through yesterday, as a matter of fact. The survey cycle is ongoing. It's going to continue for a few more weeks. So this is super current. So 66,000 is your number. 15,000 faculty, give or take a few. 28,000 undergraduates. And 22,000 staff members. And we actually expect another 15,000 or so respondents before the survey cycle closes in mid-March. So beyond the respondent population, I want to tell you a little bit about the participating institutions. And we now have 60 institutions that have taken the MISO survey since 2005. Many of these institutions have participated multiple times. In 2012, Brandeis will do its sixth administration of the MISO survey. How many have you done?
This is our fourth, I think, this year.
Brandeis is a glutton for punishment. I can explain to you why we've done so many, but it has been invaluable for accreditation, for decision-making, for service improvement. It's been phenomenal. So 60 institutions since 2005. This year, in 2012, 38 institutions are participating in the survey. Of that 38, 19 are participating for the first time. So there's a very large CLAC Oberlin contingent that is doing this survey for the very first time, which is nice. So let me tell you a little bit about what MISO measures in a bit more detail. So the core of the instrument is a set of three questions that look closely at a wide range of library and IT services. Something like 60-plus services could be included in these questions. A lot of those items are optional, so institutions do customize the instrument in focusing on the services that they need to learn about. These questions ask about how frequently these services are used, how important campus constituents consider them to be, and how satisfied campus constituents are with these services. And in addition, the survey does look at communication with campus constituents, the skill level of constituents, their self-reported skill level, and their self-reported interest in learning those same skills, software and tools that they use in the course of their academic and personal work. And there are also some demographic questions that we ask. One of those demographic questions is about the age of respondents. And actually, our faculty story toward the end of this hour will really rely on faculty age to produce some meaningful insights. So let me tell you a little bit about some of the differentiators that we see for ourselves. So the MISO instrument is very carefully constructed. It's a very high-quality instrument. We test it on a regular basis. We expand it every couple of years. This past year, for 2012, we just added some new items to measure things like multimedia streaming, web conferencing, ebook collections, physical comfort in the library, things like seating and lighting, accessibility of items in the library collection. So we continue to add to and change this instrument. So MISO also has very, very strong response rates. And this, in a lot of ways, is our biggest claim to fame. These strong response rates produce strong, comparable results. That's really the most important thing. And we're really setting the standard in this area due to our methodology. So these are the response rates that you see for 2011. So for faculty over 55%, for students over 55%, which is crazy high. Many, many other surveys can't crack 20% for students. 55% is out of control. We've had institutions that have been in the 70s and 80s for students, and that is wonderful. It really gives a great picture of what the students need. And staff, 51%. So over the course of the years since 2005, on average, each of these populations has been around 50% over that entire length of time. And honestly, the response rates are improving as we've made our methodology better. There's one institution that's participating this year. They went in 08, and they went in 10, and they're going this year. And their student response rate has gone from 20% in 08, with a lot of begging, to 35% this year, just using the standard messages and standard methodology. So this is really something that we pride ourselves on. Strong response rates produce good results. So the results are also very comparable. This is another big thing. Participating institutions get a workbook of MISO results from all of the schools that have participated across all of the years. You'll see this in a second. And this workbook really permits real analysis by normal people. So the first story you're going to hear today, our innovation story, was done by us. Kevin and I are not stat heads. Our stat head in chief is at home because he threw out his back. So we did this analysis with the workbook, not with SPSS, not with a data set that needed to be crunched, not with special expertise, with a little bit of knowledge, and with this tool that you're going to see now. So with that said, let's take a closer look at the results workbook. This is absolutely a key differentiator, and it does a bunch of things. It lets participating institutions drill into specific areas of the survey. It lets institutions compare data from their own school with data from another school. And it also lets them compare data from their own school in 1 year against their own school in another year for longitudinal comparison. And one of the very slick things this workbook does, is that it allows for the creation of custom cohorts, and you'll see that too this morning. So just for fun, let's do a couple of comparisons. This is going to be a rapid tour, so bear with me, and it's a little bit hard to read, but you'll get the sense of it. So watch for the colors. They're going to pop in a second here. So one thing to note about this particular version of the workbook, this is anonymized. So this is real school data, but names have been changed to protect the innocent. So I can't tell you which schools they are, and I couldn't have anyway, but this is the real stuff. So let's do a basic benchmark comparison. So we're going to pick two selective liberal arts institutions, and Kevin is going to add one of those institutions into group one and the other institution into group two. And as you see, as the two of them are selected, the results start to pop up. Let me give you a very quick tour. So you can see the list of schools on the left. In the middle, you can see the questions. Each individual item shows up in its own cell. The two red columns, the one with numbers shows the difference between the two groups. And the column to its right is the statistical difference test. And this is key, because A difference between two schools could be due to chance. If it's not statistically significant, it is very likely that that difference is due to chance. And that's not something you want to act on. So that statistical difference column will tell you if group 2 is higher or if group 2 is lower. And the other thing you want to look for is darker colors indicate bigger changes, bigger differences. And the other thing is red is a negative difference, green is a positive difference. So there you go. So one of the other things you can do in this workbook is you can drill in. So let's do that now. Let's drill in real quickly. Let's look at services related to course management systems and services related to classroom technology. So Kevin's going to very quickly filter for those two services. This filtering allows institutions to very quickly find the information that they need, and it makes this workbook a whole lot less overwhelming. So instead of lots and lots of questions, we see a very small set at this point. So the first few questions deal with use of these services, and the cells are blank because one of these schools didn't ask the use question. They're allowed not to if they want to. So what we see in importance is that for the course management system, for classroom technology support, there is no difference in importance between school 1 and school 2. There is a difference in the mean scores, but that difference is not statistically significant, really key. So as we look down at the satisfaction questions, you'll see there is a difference, there are strong differences, and group 2 is higher. So the school number 2 has a greater satisfaction in these areas than school number 1. So, and again, these areas are course management system, classroom technology, support for classroom technology, the time it takes to resolve classroom technology problems, and, well, there's another one in that category, but neither school asked it. My classroom computing problems are solved in a timely fashion. Oh, that's a deprecated question, actually. I take that back. So we have deprecated certain questions over the years, sometimes because their construction was inappropriate, and sometimes for other reasons. All right, so let's do one more comparison. I'm not going to do a longitudinal comparison now, but if you want to see one later on, we could do that. What I am going to do is a quick cohort comparison. So Kevin is going to add one more selective liberal arts institution to group 1, and he's going to add another selective liberal arts institution to group 2. And then we're going to filter again. Let's see. Let's filter this time for instructional technology and see what comes back. Dun, dun, dun. All right. So different results. And as you could see, as Kevin was adding schools to the cohorts, the results changed. So we have different kinds of questions that are grouped in this sort of instructional technology category. So there are questions like instructional technology support, who to contact for your instructional technology needs, are the instructional technology staff friendly, knowledgeable, reliable, responsive? So those are questions about service ethic.
Sorry to interrupt, just out of curiosity, looking at the response rate, you have significantly different response rates between the two schools. Historically, have you seen specific questions skew based on response rate?
Not specific questions, no. I mean, certainly response rate has something to do with these differences, but a difference in response rate between 67% and 55% is not going to do that. If a school is at, say, a 15% or a 20% response rate for its faculty, maybe, you know, against a school that's maybe at 60%, but not very likely.
One thing also to point out is that the statistical difference test actually takes all that into account. You know, the higher your overall response rate, the more valid you might consider those conclusions to be. But again, not being a stat head, one of the things that Dave Consiglio at Bryn Mawr has talked about is that in doing our statistical tests, he's actually doing a finite population adjustment. So it's a little bit more refined than even your traditional kind of statistical work on things, that we know exactly how many. The other thing is that the numbers of responses could change very much, because you might compare your school to a large number of schools. But as long as the statistical test works out right, you're in good shape.
You had to throw in the finite population adjustment, didn't you?
That's great.
Yeah. I wasn't going to go there. Anyway, so the other thing I want to note is there's another set of questions in this category, and it has to do with different kinds of software and cloud services and other kinds of services that are used in an instructional technology setting. So That question's included here as well. And as you can see, there are some differences. There are some areas where, for some of these questions, there is no statistically significant difference. For some, group two is higher. For some, group two is lower. And as you can see, the strength of those differences does vary. Some of those differences are large. Some of those differences are smaller. So I think I want to show you the power of the workbook, but I think that gives you a taste. The most interesting thing that we can do today is to share some insights and really get you talking. So the next thing we're going to do is to tell the first of our two stories for this morning. And this is a story about innovation and support for faculty's innovative ideas.
One of the challenges, and anybody who's ever done any of these presentations for EDUCAUSE or ELI or anything like that, that we run into is your proposal is submitted so much earlier than when the actual presentation comes around. And a lot of what we do in our presentations is share with you the latest research that we've done. The result of that is that sometimes we don't know what we're going to be presenting when we're actually sending in the proposal. But we noticed that one of the conference themes this week was about innovation. And when you're thinking about a survey like the MISO survey, which is talking about how importantly your constituencies consider your services to be, how satisfied they are, innovation was something that I wasn't so sure of what we could do. There is actually a question in the MISO survey where we ask faculty about their dissatisfaction or satisfaction with support for your innovative ideas, for the faculty innovative ideas. So that was kind of the beginning of the thinking I had here. And one of the things I was trying to figure out is there any way that the MISO survey could help pull out how innovative or how prepared to be innovative our institutions are. Part of what framed it for me was the article, I don't know if everybody saw it, and obviously he's here this week, he's not in the room, that's good. But the interview with Michael Wesch was very interesting to me this week because what we had was a situation where others have tried to use his teaching methods, the resources and things like that, without having the same results that he got. And I guess the thing that I've always felt is that oftentimes innovation, at least in teaching and learning, is something that is part of that special mix of, you know, he had talked about wonder and passion. I think those things are key, and we don't measure those in the MISO survey. But I also think that the environment needs to be ready for someone to do this kind of work. One thing that I had, this is kind of a bias on my part, but my sense is oftentimes, because innovation is so very different, what we're actually dealing with in terms of who the innovators are is that there are usually one or more champions who think different, borrowing from Apple there a little bit, who are open to experimentation using sometimes external resources, sometimes internal, but they're using them in new ways to engage students and to enhance learning. And the thing that often haunts me is that these people are not my goal. My goal in instructional technology, or if you work in a library, is actually to provide an environment where broad-based innovation can take place. People like Michael Wesch are, I think, the one percenters. I think they're the people who are self-starters, they're early technology adopters, they get out there. I need to make sure that everybody on my campus is having an opportunity to innovate. And so the question for me became, well, what do we need to provide our faculty so that they have an opportunity to innovate? I can't predict what those innovations would be, but I think certain things have to be right if we're actually to see 1,000 flowers bloom as opposed to a few. So this got me thinking about the whole hierarchy of needs, if everyone's familiar with Maslow. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but you basically have multiple levels that build upon each other in order to get a person to the point of self-actualization. And I was curious to see whether or not there had already been any kind of work about the kind of foundations that innovation in teaching and learning might take. And I guess it's a little bit rarefied because I'm thinking from a technology or information standpoint. The closest I got was a search on the internet about a hierarchy of internet needs, but this wasn't really what I was looking for. So, what I did instead is came up with my own idea, and I wanted to see how things worked from there. So I developed this hierarchy, and I have to say, this is one of those, you know, so how did you do it? Part of this is based on just the experiences and the conversations that we on the MISO survey team have all the time about what it takes for an institution to be successful. Not necessarily with regard to innovation, but just what does it take for an institution to do well. And my contention here is that you need to build up on these four areas before you get to a point where the broad base of your faculty are ready to innovate. And it's not saying that if you do these things that it'll happen, because you still have to have the faculty themselves. Go. The bottom, I'm sorry, yeah, I'm going to walk through it very quickly, but and sorry, the projection and the lighting and everything. The bottom layer is the infrastructure. And for most of us, when we come into an institution, this stuff is usually already there, and it's not that we don't change our wireless networks every few years or things like that, but the infrastructure seems to me to be the basis on which everything else seems to build. And making sure that everything from your network to your library collections to your course management system and the library databases, these are all pieces, parts of the infrastructure that need to be there before you can really get to the next step. And the next step is support, where you actually have help desks or reference. Maybe you have instructional technology or research instruction engagements with faculty, but these are the support pieces where we're making sure that not only do they have the infrastructure, but they've got what they need in order to make use of that infrastructure. The next layer up is communication. And communication actually is in multiple ways. So it's everything from understanding what system downtimes might be, through to whether or not the organizations, whether the services themselves, are getting your input about computing or library decisions that affect them. So communication works in two ways, and I guess you might even say there's a lower level of, you know, what's the status of my computer that's at the help desk, but then you've got the higher level things where you're getting into things like support for your specialized computing needs. You know, certainly different faculty and different disciplines have needs, and how well are we communicating with you to make sure that you then get the infrastructure and the support that you need. With all three of those layers covered, the next thing I think we get to is fluencies, and I mean both information literacy, and I'm not going to start picking which one to say, but information literacy or fluency, IT fluency. There's a great book, Being Fluent with Information Technologies. It came out in 99, so it's a little bit dated, but they have some great frameworks that I like to look at, and we've done a few projects at my campus as a result. But as faculty begin to understand everything about privacy issues, about copyright and fair use, and about the different technologies that are available to them as they start to learn those kinds of things, I think with all those things covered, you get to a point where innovation can now happen. It doesn't necessarily happen. You smiled when I said it the first time. So it doesn't necessarily happen, but you've at least got the environment primed for that kind of an opportunity to happen. The one thing I'll say about my model before moving on is that I think it's porous. So we've blended the layers here a little bit. My friend Hill Scott did the photoshopping for me here. But I think that there's a lot of back and forth. Some support is communication and vice versa. So I don't want to say that this is a hard and fast, clean levels in between things. But the MISO survey actually allows us to measure the satisfaction that faculty have with these different pieces. And I can frame the way we look at these services by looking at how faculty at different schools have responded to the question about how satisfied they are with support for their innovative ideas. So there were 22 schools that had participated in the MISO survey from 2009 to 2011 who asked the question about satisfaction with support for innovative ideas. And we are able to determine that the mean, this is in the workbook as Josh has said, the mean across those 3 years for all 22 of those institutions was a 3.33, just bear with me. We're trying not to get into the numbers too much, but in terms of satisfaction, that's somewhere between somewhat satisfied, which is a 3, and satisfied, which is a 4 on our overall scale of things. So a 3.33 was the mean, and there were 9 institutions that scored above that, and there were, the balance would then be 13? Institutions below that were either at or below the mean for this particular question. The way the two groups broke out, you see that the mean then for the group where satisfaction was below the overall mean was a 3.16, and the group of nine schools where they were higher had a 3.54 mean overall in terms of satisfaction with support for innovative ideas. I'm doing what Josh did with the anonymous workbook. I can't name names. What happens in Vegas is one of the things here. We don't share, especially other schools' results. I guess Josh and I could divulge whatever we wanted about our schools, but we don't talk about other school results. But if you are a MISO school member, you can go into the workbooks and do this kind of work on your own.
And I do want to emphasize that there's no magic here. So if any of you are already MISO participants, you could go in and do this analysis for your own school the minute you leave here.
So everyone understands the basic model. And what I'm trying to do is, by splitting people apart, by splitting faculty who were above the mean and below the mean in terms of satisfaction with support for their innovative ideas, I then wanted to look at each of those layers, at the infrastructure, at the support, at the communication, and at the fluencies level, according to what the MISO data said. And at first I did this against just one school, but then we broke it out so that we did it to all schools. And I was a little bit surprised by the way things broke. For the infrastructure question, there were 29 items that are in the survey where we measure faculty satisfaction with infrastructure items. And again, these are things from the online library catalog, the course management system, network speed and stability, and things like that. Of the 29, 28 of those services were statistically significant, and they were all in favor of what I would call the satisfied innovators. This, in other words, the higher of the two groups. It's not that either group was dissatisfied, but the group where there was a statistically significant difference in terms of satisfaction, where they were more satisfied, this is a subset of them. We're trying to simplify, but also to give you an idea of the kinds of items that faculty were finding, that they were more satisfied at the satisfied innovators than their counterparts at the somewhat satisfied schools. So we then looked at support as the next thing, the next piece up in the pyramid. And once again, we had, I have to get the number here so I get it right, I believe there were 16 services, and out of those 16, all 16 were statistically significantly in favor of the faculty at the schools where they were happier with innovation overall. We did communication, and there were 13 out of 15, items actually broke in favor of the satisfied innovators school. In all three of these cases, not a single variable went in favor of the somewhat satisfied. There was either everything went in favor, as with support, or the things that didn't move, simply there was no statistically significant difference between them. So when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to support, when it comes to communication, everything seems to be happier, seems to be more satisfied at the institutions where the satisfied innovators are coming. It gets a little bit more complicated when we get to fluencies. And part of this is because the MISO survey asks, as Josh was mentioning, we ask questions about your skill level. So we want to know how much you think, how proficient you are with Word, with GIS, with a number of different things, search engines and so forth. So that was what your skills are. We also then ask, what's your interest in learning more about them? And we found that with regard to learning more about them, we had, just trying to see the number again. We had 13 out of 29 skills where there was no statistically significant difference. But we had 13 out of 24, I'm trying to make sure I've got my notes right, that were in favor of the satisfied innovator school once again. These are some of those particular things, but the faculty at the satisfied innovator schools are more interested in learning. There was nothing breaking in terms of interest in learning towards the somewhat satisfied faculty. It was all statistically significantly higher. And I should mention, because we get into these conversations frequently as a team, there's statistically significant, and then there's kind of practically significant, if you follow me, you know. And all of these numbers are actually breaking with such a magnitude that there is a practical significance to what we're seeing. Things are moving 0.2 of a point, which is actually quite a bit when you're talking about a 4-point scale. So big differences here. But when it came to the skills, we actually had a split. This was the one place where things broke out. So there were 13 areas where there was no difference. So in voicemail, faculty everywhere are relatively the same in terms of what they pursue. And this is also a good way for you to understand some of the things that get asked about in the MISO survey. Online catalog, library databases, database software, social software, which is wikis and blogs, and then kind of ineffable things like solving computer problems. There was no difference between faculty at these two different groups. Where we did see differences was between the somewhat satisfied innovators and the satisfied innovators. And I've condensed them. I've thrown a few things out. And one of the things I wanted to ask, and I'll stand up a little bit about this, is whether you guys see any pattern to this, or you see any rhyme or reason as to why faculty at the satisfied or the somewhat satisfied institutions might feel one way over another. I'll preface it a little bit by saying that when we talk about skills, there are often some things that as you become more and more proficient, you're less and less interested in knowing about it, right? Once you kind of have email, you're not interested in really getting to know email any better. But Photoshop, GIS, these are things that the more you know, the more you tend to be drawn into those kinds of things.
I should just stick in that Kevin's not just offering a thought. A prior analysis that we did leads to that conclusion.
Thank you. But as I've stared at this, I've tried to figure out, you know, what are the patterns? And I see things that are both, you know, once you've got IM, instant messaging, right? Not much more there. So it's not something about their interest in learning or that they feel that they need more skills. But these folks feel they are better at these things than the somewhat satisfied innovators, and these folks feel that they're better at those skills than the satisfied innovators. Is there any sense? Because one of the things that we often find with any survey is that it raises more questions. And I've been very confused by the way things broke out here. I see some very sophisticated things, math or statistics software, so SPSS. And we've raised different conjectures, you know, that if you are a little less satisfied with your institution's support for innovation, is it that you teach yourself more, and so you're more independent, and so you rate yourself more highly than you might in other places?
So I think at this point we want to pause and ask you to bring some meaning to this. We have some ideas, we have some interpretations, but really this is the moment where I'm hoping that we'll all talk together a little bit. So one thing to remember is this session is being streamed, so for those of you who want to speak, you need a mic. Otherwise, the people on their campuses will never hear you. So anyway, what do you all make of this?
And we can also talk about the model that I've kind of stitched together and go through any of that if you're interested too. But
at a glance, it looks like the column on the left, the somewhat in satisfied innovators, the things that the, if I understand this right, the things that they feel that they are...
They're more highly skilled at those things than their counterparts.
Less innovative things. They're more traditional technologies. And some are more sophisticated than others. That doesn't seem to be the difference. But, they're things that might have been on a list 15 years ago.
That's really interesting and not something I had picked up.
I wonder what others think. I mean, as I look at these lists, that is one very valid interpretation. It's also possible to say course management systems have been around for a long time. ERP self-service, not a new technology. So what do others think of this? And more broadly, what do we make of this analysis that schools where support for innovative ideas is high are also schools where support for these other core services is also high? What can we learn from this, and what do we make of it?
Josh. Ronnie.
I think one thing that, I mean, I kind of see is that the things on the right make people seem perhaps more self-sufficient. You have avoiding computer problems, and that to me, when your faculty, staff, and students feel like there's things they can do themselves, it doesn't generally mean that the other services have been neglected. It means the other services have been done really well so that they can help themselves. So that might kind of hint towards better communication, better infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing I would want to know from this is there's using a course management system, and there's using a course management system innovatively. So you would want to know what...
Are we getting into analytics?
Yes.
Another buzzword. And you know, MISO survey is not really analytics, but yeah, digging into your course management system and seeing. Aaron.
I wonder if you're pushing it too far to look at groups of colleges different than others, whereas I think these things might be more localized and you're looking for a large scale pattern where it might just be local variations. For instance, maybe one campus hasn't really promoted their math and statistics software as well as the other. So you could use that on your campus, but I'm not sure putting together 13, 23, whatever schools, that there is a large-scale pattern there.
Right. We know that the differences are statistically significant, so there's something to that, and that we've accounted for differences between schools. It's another piece that we do through here. Josh, we have another up here. But I think it's a good point. I actually did this first, looking at Brandeis and Richmond and then a few others, doing one-offs, and I saw a similar pattern kind of showing up. I'm not saying where we were.
The other thing I would note is that the more schools you throw into the cohort, the more the school effect that you're talking about tends to be muted. You know, one school against another or two schools against two, I would absolutely and completely agree. There is some school effect in here, without a doubt. When we do trends over time, we use a different analysis that accounts for school effect and controls for it. In this case, we didn't, but it's my contention that with the number of schools here, that's not as much of a drag on this analysis as it might otherwise be.
The column on the left sort of is very individualized use and personal focused, where the top two items on the right are actually community focused. They're broader in scope. Mm-hmm. So privacy issues don't just affect me, but they affect the people I serve.
Right.
And so there's sort of a more sophisticated thinking about the technology on the right-hand side rather mm-hmm. than on the left. And so perhaps the support in those institutions have gotten those individualized issues taken care of, allowing that innovation.
That's great. And I will say, we actually did combine in this category. There were questions about skills. There were also questions about whether you feel informed or not. And the first two issues in this right column, since you mentioned them, were how informed I am about that. And that's a different scale and everything, but again, we had a statistically significant break. And to me, this is part of the fluencies that I'm arguing have to be in place, kind of broadly speaking, for your faculty to be ready to start using technology and information resources in their innovations.
The two that really jump out at me are privacy issues and copyright and fair use. Because there really isn't anything how-to tool-oriented about those mm-hmm. two, whereas some of the others, you know, like your email. You know.
Yeah, so I'd actually say avoiding computer problems is one of those two. And we had one earlier, and there was no difference in solving computer problems, but avoiding them in the first place. And one of the things I can tell you just from Richmond, this is, and I think this is true across MISO schools, Josh will correct me if I'm wrong, that's the skill that most faculty are most interested in. You know, there are other things, you know, GIS and things like that, but avoiding computer problems, you know, if you can put workshops together on that, they'll probably show up in better numbers than they do to PowerPoint or...
Okay, it seems to me that looking at the email versus the instant messaging and looking at Word, spreadsheet, and presentation, mm-hmm. opposite copyright, that on the right, they're further ahead in the curve. Because copyright and fair use and privacy issues, to me, speaks to they're doing some innovating, but now they're worried about, like with the analytics, the privacy issue.
Mm-hmm.
That they're already doing that, and that's why that becomes an issue for them. Same thing with copyright. It's going to be difficult for every single individual faculty member to use innovative technology all on their own. I mean, what we saw yesterday with the science virtual reality, that can't be done on an individual basis.
Yes.
You've got to go out there and find something that someone else has done, and that's when copyright and fair use becomes really important.
This was the Chris Deedy stuff where he was walking through the pond and stuff like that?
I mean, that can't be, you know, your typical middle school science teacher in Podunk, Texas doesn't have the way to do it. So they're having to go out and find these things, and then they become concerned about copyright and fair use.
It's interesting.
I actually would like to see us take a step back for just a minute. So we've been focused pretty heavily for the last few minutes on the fluencies. Before we turn to another story, I'm curious what thoughts you have about what this overall story, thinking about the model in its entirety, what this overall story tells us about our faculty, about our services, what it suggests about future directions. Anyone have any thoughts along those lines?
Let me just take this along a step or two further. I mean, I basically just stitched together an idea that I wasn't sure until we did the numbers, but it seems to me that the numbers were validating something about this model. There could be completely other ways that this would be there, and one of the things we've talked back and forth about is whether it's really a pyramid, or is it just, you know, if infrastructure is there, then somebody's going to be able to do it and they don't need the other pieces. I'm sticking with it where I am right now, but I'm curious about just takes about this and what it means back at our institutions.
Your definition of innovation, is that just the early use before others of the application of technology, or is it doing something unique? Because it seems like institutionally, once we sort of created the cookie cutter, any other institution can go off and use that. And so those fundamental things that showed on the left slightly less sophistication use, once we get them up now, will they be innovators?
Yeah, it's not about making everybody early adapters. You know, I think the curve is always going to be the curve in terms of adoption and things like that. So I think it's and I also think that any kind of instructional innovation is very difficult for us to imagine what that would be, because if we could name it, it's probably happened or something like that. But I guess I mean it more in your second sense, that there is something between the instructor, how that instructor thinks about teaching and what they think about student learning, and then these other pieces and the content that they're working on that all come together to usually end up in a one-off solution, which is why maybe Michael Wesch's stuff doesn't work if you're teaching physical chemistry. But there are things that you might find based on, you know, your own experience, that if our campuses are doing these things, I guess I'm saying, we are making it easier for our faculty to be able to do those things with or without our support.
There is one other point to make about innovation in this context. So what you have to remember about a survey is that, as I'm standing behind all of you, sorry about that, these questions are need to be written and tested so that they're properly understood by respondents. So we thought about the definition of innovation in this context yesterday, and what I come back to is how faculty respondents understand this question. Support for your innovative ideas, what does this mean to them? And when we did the testing of these questions this past spring and summer, really innovation was lightly defined. You know, something exciting and new in their courses that they haven't done before, something that is new to their teaching or their scholarship that makes a difference. So I think in a lot of ways our tighter definitions of innovation maybe don't need to be part of the conversation. And this is certainly in the minds of faculty, this is a much more loosely defined concept. So let me, Joe can have the last word, and then we'll turn to another story and let you guys comment on that.
Something which occurred to me thinking about communication and support is that faculty members have multiple sources for those. And, you know, the way MISO is designed, you're trying to get at the issue of communication and support from the library IT organization. But, you know, the one that comes to mind is support structures in faculty spouse couples are really interesting.
We don't survey that.
You know, the issue of are you supported within your department? Is there communication within your department? Is another wrinkle that's outside the scope of what we're dealing with, but it's probably worth thinking about in our local context.
Right. I will say that I think that what the way the MISO survey is constructed, it's talking about the services regardless of their point of origin, but they are focused towards information and technology issues. So yes, I mean there are all sorts of other things that I think, you know, is the provost behind this, you know, all kinds of other things. But yeah, just for the part that we ourselves are responsible for is, I guess, what we focused on here.
So let's turn to a different story, another story about faculty, but this time looking at faculty in terms of how they view services at different points in their careers. So as I mentioned, one of the questions that we ask faculty in the instrument, we ask a similar question of staff and a related question of students. The question of faculty is, how old are you? And we give them eight choices, you know, 25 to 35, you know, so there are a range of choices in the instrument. So what we did was an initial analysis as we thought about faculty, thinking about how they view services. Is it the tenured faculty view services different from faculty who have not yet achieved tenure? Does rank make a difference? And one of the things we found through a preliminary analysis is that tenure and rank map very well to age. So not so surprisingly, so our youngest faculty tend to be tenure track, but not tenured. They tend to be assistants, not associates. As you move up in age, there's a switch at age 40 to where more professors are tenured than not tenured, and the rank increases as they get older. So what we did was to break the faculty respondents into four age groups. So we have 39 and younger, 40 to 49, 50 to 59, and 60 and older. And this slide just shows you the breakdown of those four groups, how the respondents are distributed across the four groups. So it's roughly even, but not exactly even. So what did we find? The big idea here is that younger faculty demand online services and direct access to content much more than their older peers do, and they are less satisfied overall with IT and library services. So if you think about those two things, there's a sea change coming. So this this visualization summarizes that sea change. So these are, each of those lines represents an average, a weighted mean of all of the services for which there is a statistically significant difference due to age. So these are the services for which age matters. So we created a weighted mean of all the services for which age matters in the context of satisfaction, and all the services for which age matters in the context of the importance of those services. So what do we see here? We see, and one other thing I should note, the youngest faculty are on the right. So if you want to see the future of your institution, look to the right-hand side of this chart. So those two lines are converging. What's happening? Younger faculty are less satisfied overall than their older peers. And you can see that line ticking downward with each successive age group. Regarding importance of services, our oldest faculty find services to be less important than their peers in the three younger age groups. So there is not a statistically significant difference between 50 to 59, 40 to 49, and 39 and younger, but those three groups find all these services to be more important than their older peers. So it cuts differently depending upon the service that we're talking about. This pattern is much more prominent for services that provide, for online systems, online services, services that provide direct access to content. And it's also very prominent for support services. So let's drill in very, very quickly. So there are a lot of lines on these charts, I apologize, but look for the tilt. So on this first chart are services like the VPN, classroom technology, library databases, wireless access. You can see a lot of these services tilt upward, and this is an importance chart. So for our youngest faculty, these services are much more important to them than they are to their older peers. So direct access to content, online services. Who was it that said, give me what I need and get out of the way? Was that Michael Wesch himself? Yeah, so when I see this, I think of that. So let's look at a different angle here. So again, look at the tilt. So this chart is mostly comprised of support services. So we have email spam filtering, help desk schedule, campus telephone support, help desk support for your laptop and desktop problems. We see a tilt in the other direction. Our youngest faculty find these services to be less important than their older peers. So you put it all together, and what have you got? You've got this situation where our much-loved, burnish-to-a-fine-sheen support processes, the way in which we provide in-depth, customized, terrifically wonderful help for our faculty constituencies, our youngest faculty don't want that, or they want it less than their older peers. So they find these services to be more important. They need services that give them what they need, and they don't really want to need our help. So there is a dramatic change coming in the nature of the way we're going to work with, consult with, assist, support our faculty populations.
If I can jump in here, part of the contention that we're making here, and we keep coming back to this every year to see if the model is holding true, if it's more valid than it goes, you can assume a couple of different things. Either, as faculty get older, then these guys will start behaving like these, and that'll be true. Or you can say, no, there are global changes that are happening, and the people who are using Skype now will be using Skype when they're 55. And we're leaning on that latter case, I think, when we're saying that what you see here is actually going to turn through the rest of the population as we go, perhaps with the stakes continuing to rise.
And one of the things that's super exciting for us is that with the addition of the data from this year's administration of the survey, those 38 schools, we will finally have enough data to answer that question. So check back in October. Our hope is to pursue that line of analysis over the summer and have much more to report. So let me offer you one other thought to raise the ante and bring us back around to innovation. I know I said I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to. So age matters regarding the importance of support for your innovative ideas and satisfaction with support for your innovative ideas. So as you can see, there is younger faculty are less satisfied with support for their innovative ideas than older faculty, and they find that support to be more important. And even more interestingly, faculty 39 and younger are the only faculty to find support for their innovative ideas important. The other faculty, older faculty members, their older peers find it slightly less important. So not only do we need to change the way we work with faculty, but from an innovation perspective, the bar is raised. Younger faculty find that service to be more important, that support for their innovative ideas. And it's our contention that all of the other services need to be drilled as well to get there. So I'm curious about your thoughts on this. What does it say about our faculty? What does it suggest about our next steps in the coming years?
One thought is quick, like, what are we going to stop doing to be able to support the innovators? I'm intrigued that there's some that on the previous slide that need less help with a lot of the sort of disintermediation type of services. And I'm thinking that these are the people that grew up with ATM machines and are very comfortable doing things themselves, in a sense. And so that doesn't surprise me, I guess, that a lot of these services are less important for the younger faculty.
We do have to be a little bit careful, and I think you're really dead on, but we do have to be a little bit careful because it's not that they need less help. It's that they find that help to be less important. So there's a nuance there, and you may be exactly right, but the data doesn't indicate that. Other thoughts?
We've been participating in the survey for quite a while. I'm from Bucknell. And when we've looked at this data, we've tended to say that, you know, rightly or wrongly, you all might have some other insights, but, you know, it seems to us that younger folks see a lot of these services kind of like we think about electricity. They're still necessary, but it's just a basic level of support that they just have come to expect. So if we took those away, there probably would be some degree of dissatisfaction if viruses were running wild, say. But it's just sort of what they've come to expect. So for us to remain really relevant in partnering with them, it really is about figuring out how to do the innovative stuff, but we can't necessarily let go of some of these other things that are sort of fundamental to keeping the basic services, basic service level intact.
That is definitely one of the challenges. Can we throw up the quadrant slide?
Yeah.
So we're nearly at time, but I couldn't resist throwing this out there because it does relate to your question. I have two responses to the point that you made. One is that I think that you may be onto something and there is more analysis to be done. This data set may offer some. You all may be able to do some analyses at your institution to shed some light on that question. This the chart that Kevin is going to throw up here in a minute shows you it's there. Wonderful. These are services with overall trends in both importance and satisfaction. So to the question, what should we do less of or do in a more streamlined way or resource a little bit less, this chart shows some juxtaposition that may shed some light on that. So the lower left-hand quadrant are those services which are diminishing both in importance and in satisfaction. So there really is only one for faculty. There are a few more for students in that quadrant, but we won't get there today. Library reference services is in that quadrant. As we look in the upper right-hand quadrant, services that are increasing in importance and satisfaction. So one could say that's a good story, or we could say, wow, you know, given what we've just heard, what are we going to do to resource all of those? You know, do we pull back a little bit because satisfaction is on the rise? Do we trade on that a little bit? What do we do? And what about services like library liaison and library databases, where importance is up but satisfaction is down?
One thing to add, looking at something like, how many library people do we have? Good. Yay, library. So when you look at something like library reference going down, one of the things, we also measure a couple other directions, and we are seeing movement toward those things and away from reference. So it's the library liaison relationship with faculty, and it's the library research instruction that are both kind of moving upward, and they're actually the research instruction is moving for students as well. Lots of different things that this could mean. It could mean that students are looking for more just-in-time expert conversations because they want to have a sit-down conversation with the social sciences, you know, library liaison or something like that. But there are also others who are out there saying, you know, what this means is we need to rethink reference and deliver it in a new and better way because the fact that it's trending downward in importance and satisfaction is wrong. We need to correct people's impressions, right? So there are different takes you could bring to this.
We have this debate all the time in the MISO survey team, and you know, some of us hate the E word. It's my personal contention. I won't pin this on anyone else yet. The E word, yes, that the movement is towards services that that empower faculty and students to do what they need to do. So it's that E word that some of my team members hate. It might be I might be putting some bias on this, but it is possible to have that interpretation of this. Did you?
No, it was right here.
Oh, it was you. Sorry.
Yep.
About that.
I just had a question. It might be clear to everyone else, but not so much for me. The library reference service, and you're asking the faculty this, was that their importance and satisfaction with reference for their research needs
right.
or for their students' research needs?
It's however they read the question. And again, the satisfaction is how dissatisfied or satisfied are you with library reference services. When we test the question, faculty articulate an answer and the question is not broken in any way. What I will say is that you get different interpretations. The one that I had back on my campus actually referred to library space. And on the use question, faculty said, I don't use it very much. But when it got to the importance question, they said, my students use it a ton and they need that or they're not going to do well in my class, so it's very important to me. That's an acceptable answer.
And to your point, library reference services, when we test it, is generally understood as service at the answers to questions at the point of service, so it's a reference desk kind of interaction.
Right.
You know, but for sure, faculty who taught saw this as being about their own needs and about their students' needs. And faculty who, there you go. I mean, so services that had to do with teaching tended to be understood by faculty as covering the students as well as the faculty members themselves. Services that had less to do with teaching tended to be more of an individual focus. So it is about 2 minutes of nine. We're almost at time. I am curious whether anyone has any last comments that they'd like to share, either about this faculty age story or about the innovation story.
Do you want to give them friendly?
Okay. Let's send you out the door with something friendly.
You want to do this one?
Yeah, sure, I'll do it. As Kevin's bringing up what we have loved to call the friendly story, I do want to let you know about some future directions of analysis for us. So I mentioned the cohort analysis for faculty. So trying to figure out whether faculty's views on these services are things that they carry forward through their careers or whether it is really related to the stage in their career. We're also going to begin to do a disciplinary analysis for faculty, looking at the views of services for faculty in the arts, the humanities, the social sciences, the STEM disciplines. And ideally, we will have disciplinary trends, changes in views of services over time within a discipline. So we very much hope to be able to do that. So let me send you out the door with the friendly story, and hopefully many of you will see us, hear from us in the coming months as we pursue these avenues of analysis. So there are several questions stuck in the middle of the survey that ask about the service ethic of staff at various service points. So for each of these service points, respondents are asked to rate the staff on four different aspects of service: reliability, responsiveness, knowledge, and friendliness. So it is a contention on the part of many of us that it's the friendliness, the interpersonal nature of the contact at a service point that really makes the difference. And so our question is, how much of satisfaction with these services can be explained by those four attributes? So for help desk, 45% of satisfaction can be explained. Do you want to do faculty friendly?
We're going to start with this and then jump. I wanted to just explain that we can only explain a percentage, and it's different by the service what those four variables will. So reference, there are other things other than those four variables, but we can explain 20% of the satisfaction with that service overall.
And just to put this in context, explaining 45% of satisfaction is a ton. Explaining 20% of reference and a little less than that of circulation is really not all that much. So And now the big reveal.
Yeah, we'll go to the faculty one directly.
So you'll notice friendly is the blue stuff on the bottom. So friendly explains relatively little of satisfaction here. So for faculty, there are five services for which satisfaction can be explained this way. For help desk, it's actually nearly 60% that can be explained for faculty. For reference, it's something like 20%. Instructional technology, a little bit more than that. But as you look across the board, friendliness explains very little. So our takeaway is there is a certain minimum amount of social skills that's required in a lot of these services. Our PI, David Consiglio, who's at home nursing his back, says, you know, it's the jerk quotient. Don't be a jerk, and then the rest of it trumps. But look up at the top of each one of those bars. Responsiveness tends to be the most important thing, generally followed by reliability, although knowledge is strong in a couple of these services.
Right, for reference.
Right, for reference, ERP. For ERP, exactly. So for at least for help desk circulation and instructional technology, what you see is that it's all about your workflow. It's all about drilling that workflow, making sure that the service is repeatable, it's consistent. Hopefully it's consistently good, but at least it's consistent. You know, because you can always move upward from there. And for services like reference and ERP, it's knowledge that counts most. But in a lot of ways, these are things that we wouldn't have expected. So so we'll send you out the door with this story, this friendly story. So when you go back to your staff, tell them, don't be a jerk. Focus on your workflows.
Get back to people quickly.
That's right, exactly. So I want to thank you all for really participating as much as you did at 8 o'clock in the morning. The passing around of mics and the sitting in rows is never conducive to that. So thank you all so much. This is really exciting stuff for us. And I hope that that we'll see you in the future, because we've got some more exciting stories to bring and more conversations to have. So anyway, thanks so much. Safe travels home.
Thank you very much.